Today's program has been brought to you by White Oak Pastures, a five-generation Georgia-based beef and poultry farm determined to conduct business in an honorable manner. For more information, visit whiteoakpastures.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning and welcome to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis, Executive Vice President of the James Beard Foundation. And every Wednesday we broadcast live from a little shipping container attached to the side of Roberta's Restaurant in Bushwick, Brooklyn, from here to all points around the world through the magic of the internet. But Wednesdays, now, we are live in the studio, and today it's a real pleasure to welcome a chef, I think, who has helped in some ways to define a type of cuisine that is inspired by the seasons, by vegetables, by all of the sorts of things that we talk about when we talk about sustainability, when we talk about local food, but we don't always know how that comes together, what that tastes like, let's say, how that coheres into a sense of cuisine. And Dan Kluger, who was with me in the studio, chef of ABC Kitchen and also ABC Cocina, but part of a vision for a restaurant, a new sort of restaurant, ABC Kitchen being the place where there are as many purveyors, farmers, artisans on the menu as there are dishes, where it's chic and cool to eat vegetables, all the sorts of things we imagine to be possible but don't always realize, even among chefs who talk about them. So much so that ABC Kitchen won the 2011 James Beard Award for Best New Restaurant. That is largely due to the work of Dan. So thank you for joining me.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's talk about this idea. I mean, obviously we'll be talking specifically about ABC Kitchen, but really your experience at the Union Square Hospitality Group, working with Tom Colicchio at the Core Club, all these sorts of things obviously informed what came together with the collaboration with Jean-Georges Van Richten and his team to create a menu that in some ways, although totally yummy and approachable and sounding healthy just to read it, is really the, as I said, the embodiment of all of these things we keep talking about, the station is built on, but you don't always see when you go to a restaurant. Talk to me a little bit about how it came to be and what your vision for it was.
I mean, I think, you know, Jean-Georges and Phil Suarez, partners in all the Jean-Georges restaurants, had been thinking of doing something for a while, and Phil already had two spots in ABC Home and Carpet. And one of them being Lucy's, which was what is today ABC Kitchen, mm-hmm. was in need of a change. And I think, you know, they felt like, especially ABC's vision of being very green and very environmentally friendly, they felt like it was time for a change. Mm. And so Phil and Jean-Georges had kind of come up with this idea to do sort of this farm to table. I mean, hence the Alice Waters kind of correlation.
Right. But everybody says farm to table. Yeah. And you know, sometimes you need a microscope to find a vegetable in a farm to table restaurant.
Exactly. And I think, you know, without a whole lot of thought in terms of how it would really end up, the scope of what mm-hmm. would take place, the idea was to create this restaurant based on, you know, local seasonal food. Jean-Georges is, in general, very much based on the seasons.
Of course.
Likes to shop at the farmer's market. We met at the farmer's market.
Oh, funny.
We were both at Buried Treasure stand and kind of bumped into each other, and Frank introduced us, and we hit it off. And literally, I think a week later or 2 weeks later, I was signed on with him.
Wow, that's a good story.
And I think, you know, at that point, he had seen me carrying all these bags of vegetables, and I think he had a good feeling that I was committed to the farmers and the farmer's market. And so it was a good fit. And so when we started ABC Kitchen, again, we really started with this mindset of just creating a good restaurant, good mm-hmm. food, good restaurant, based on locally, seasonally driven ingredients. And as it took shape, and I think as I got more and more involved and more excited about it, and one of my sous chefs and I would be talking about things, we wanted to try and really focus on this local. Mm-hmm. Look for every single cheese, all the dairy, all the eggs, you know, even things that weren't going to be local. Could we find small artisanal producers, whether it's the nuts or the vinegars, the oils, all these things? And so, you know, without a doubt, there's no way you're going to be 100% local.
Right.
And, you know, there's no way that you're not going to have to use some larger format things. But even through that, I think we looked for smaller producers of things. California Olive Ranch being an olive oil that we fell in love with, and it seemed like they embodied some of the things that we were looking for, mm-hmm. sustainably and as a small company.
What were some of the surprises? I mean, there's the idea of that, and then there's the reality. I mean, we were just talking before we went on air, the volume increases every day. It's an amazingly successful enterprise. Mm-hmm. What were the surprises in the evolution of trying to focus on either even just small producers, let alone local, or and also I imagine the cost constraints of mm-hmm. that, and how you've put all the pieces into a viable business.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, surprise-wise, I don't know if there were a ton of surprises, so to speak, but there were a lot of roadblocks. Like we would find something we really liked, and we thought we were moving down the right path, and then boom, couldn't get it anymore. The farmer couldn't produce enough, or whatever it was. And so I think that was definitely a struggle. Like right when we think we have all the pieces in line, and we have this great dairy, all of a sudden we find out that the farm producing the dairy had changed the way they were pasteurizing the milk, and now the outcome of the milk was different than what we expected. Mm-hmm. So now we had to go and look for something different.
Interesting.
So little things like that I think were a surprise. And I think if we were smaller scale, it may not have made such a big difference.
Right.
But our volume is so vast that it makes it tough. Having the volume be so vast is actually a huge help for us as well. It makes me feel good that, you know, everything we're doing really supports our local farmers, our community of farmers. And to me, that's a big part of the sustainable part of it. You know, it's not just about being green, because, you know, the green thing is, there's a lot of parts to that.
Mm-hmm.
And again, there are a lot of different opinions in terms of what that means. And there are people who think that the local farmers driving down in their trucks every day to the farmer's market's not necessarily the best thing either.
Right.
So to me, the sustainable is also about sustaining our community. And these farmers are there. They have the land. They need to grow the land. So the fact that we've been able to increase our volume with them, as well as our business yearly, has made it more applicable for them to go and use their hothouses or mm-hmm. to put, you know, to plant more Brussels sprouts or whatever it's going
to
be.
Invest in their own businesses.
Yeah.
So what sort of volume are we talking about? What's a busy Saturday at ABC? How many covers do you do?
About 900 to 1,000 through ABC Kitchen. And then probably about 600 to 700 at ABC Cocina.
Okay, that's a lot of people. Yeah,
it's a lot of Brussels sprouts.
Yeah, that's a lot of Brussels sprouts. So what about that? I mean, I know that it's going to sound almost cliche, but as someone who eats out a lot and has the fortune to participate in chef events, the lowly vegetable is one of the rarest things mm-hmm. in a celebration meal. And from the second that you guys opened, the buzz on the street was like, oh my God, this is a vegetable forward restaurant. Not to say it's vegetarian, mm-hmm. although I bring vegetarians there all the time, but that there are some production issues, not just from supply from the restaurants, but you know, people will tell you that starting with Brussels sprouts on a stick or whatever, on the mm-hmm. stalk, I should say, adds to production, adds to, you know, different, changes the division of work in the kitchen,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
especially at that volume.
I'd say labor tends to be very high. Mm. You know, it's not that we don't have protein. We certainly have a fair share of protein, but because we make the menu very vegetable driven, rather than protein driven, even a dish that has protein on it, typically the vegetable ends up being a little more of the star of it, so to speak. It's not compared to some of the restaurants I worked in the past and some of the restaurants where I go and eat, the protein is a big part and the vegetable is sort of the small,
it's the American way. That's,
yeah.
You know,
this is, vice versa.
Right.
And so while the vegetables are all extremely expensive, I mean, you know, we try and buy everything from the farmers as much as possible. So if you take onions, let's say, onions from the farmers versus onions from wherever
California,
they come from.
California, wherever, China, sure. Who knows, right?
Onions from the farmers are going to be 2-3 times the price.
Right.
And
you need a lot of onions in a restaurant.
Exactly.
So
you know, in terms of that, the price is still high, but by making it very vegetable-driven and a little bit less protein-driven, I think we've been able to manage the costs. Mm. One of the costs that I think is inherent through all the vegetables is the labor.
Right.
You know, you go to like pea soup and a side of peas in the middle of, you know, late spring, early summer.
Right.
And it's, you know, hours and hours and hours to keep up with what the volume that we need.
To shuck the peas.
Yeah. I mean, right. We were going through, I think, between the two restaurants, we were going through some like 80 pounds of English peas a day and 65, 70 pounds of sugar snap peas a day. And every one of those needs to be cleaned in some form or another. So I'd say that the biggest cost ends up being labor just because of the very vegetable-driven menu.
And would you, so, I mean, these sound, in some ways, they sound like small concerns, but when in the conversation is about sustainability, as you alluded to, scalability is one of the biggest things. We hear people don't have the time. I mean, just on a personal level, let alone chefs in a kitchen, which is a busy, busy environment. And I guess in any, throughout any of that, was there pushback? Are there decisions you make based on those specific challenges to what you're doing? Do the guests respond? Clearly they're coming, but it, you know, does anyone ever say, where's the meat? Where's my steak? Or I'm just curious about how it's all received. And I do mean it when I say that it's sort of the vision of a restaurant we all talk about, but you're living the reality of that.
I think rarely do you hear, where's the beef?
Right.
That's probably the one thing that, out of anything, the one thing that we might hear is, I want a steak.
Uh-huh.
You know, very rarely we do it. When we do it, we typically are trying to buy from a small farm. And, you know, the price of it's so expensive that, you know, to pass it on to the customer means, like, you know, a $60 steak in order to keep up with things. And, you know, nobody wants a 4-ounce steak necessarily.
Right. It's an insult.
So, you know, in terms of that, you hear that every once in a while. But I think for the most part, yeah, they respond really well. And if you look at, you know, if you look at a sales mix, the majority of the dishes end up being, or the high sellers end up being vegetable driven. Mm. So I think they respond well to it. You know, it's in terms of the scalability, it's a challenge, I think. We have a ton of staff working for us. We figure out things every day in terms of how to adjust to make things better in terms of the labor. But probably the one thing that we can't do as easily as maybe a smaller restaurant would do is, you know, just go out and create a couple new dishes on the fly and put them on the menu tomorrow. There's a whole lot more thought that goes into it. Again, can they keep up? Can the farmer keep up with our volume? Will they be able to produce it for the next, you know, 2 weeks, 3 weeks? What does it mean for us labor-wise? So,
right.
You know, every additional menu item is additional labor. We're not just, you know, losing things. So, it makes us look at in the middle of, you know, late spring, early summer when we have English peas, fava beans, all these things being cleaned, which is probably one of our like biggest labor times a year with the prep
funny.
Crew.
I mean, it's not funny, but it's amazing to think about. Yeah.
But it makes you say, okay, so now there's this like amazing thing at the market. Can we add it right now?
Right.
And so sometimes we end up maybe not necessarily doing those additions that we'd like to just based on the labor of the vegetables.
My next question, and then we'll move on to another topic about it, is from the perspective of a manager of a kitchen, which is as much a part of your job as a cook, do you find we have a dreamy romantic image that working with beautiful seasonal produce is more gratifying for the cook, you know, that the soul-sucking opening of the Cisco bag of frozen peas, you know, is evident in the food, let's say, or in the morale of the staff. Do you, I mean, faced with 80 pounds of peas to shuck, in a morning. That could be demoralizing. That's a mountain of peas to you have to surmount. But do you think that the quality, the beauty of the stuff, there's something more to the motivation of the staff and the morale because of what they're handling?
Again, I think it's all a matter of the cook,
right?
Whether it's with us or anywhere, what their long-term vision is. But I think in general, people get excited. They start to see this, especially when they, you know, spend time working in seasonal restaurants where the menu is constantly changing based on the season. They start to see it as like one more sign. Oh, here's spring. Oh, here's summer. You know, great. There's watermelons. Mm. Great. There's this. So I think it does help to spark a little excitement. I would like to believe that, you know, when they see the fresh peas coming in or the fresh sugar snap peas coming in, the prep crew is, yes, you know, flabbergasted by the amount they have to do, but once it makes its way to the cook has a little more respect for it than if they were to have just opened that bag of, right, you know, whoever's frozen peas it is.
Right.
But again, it really depends on the cooks, I think. For me, for the sous chefs, for I think the managers and a lot of the servers, we do get very excited by the seasonal change and what's about to come and knowing that, you know, we literally just picked this up from the farmer's market and we're about to start cooking it.
Right.
I think it does show in the food and it makes it a little bit easier to talk about it. And, you know, without being corny, you sort of have a story to tell.
Right. Well, we'll have more stories to hear from Dan Kluger, the chef of ABC Kitchen and ABC Cocina, who is my guest today on Taste Matters. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back.
White Oak Pastures is the only farm in the United States that has its own USDA-inspected red meat abattoir or slaughterhouse and its own USDA-inspected poultry abattoir or slaughterhouse. We partner with Whole Foods to deliver our high-quality meat and poultry from Miami, Florida, all the way to Princeton, New Jersey. One family, one farm, five generations, 145 years. Full circle return to sustainable land stewardship and humane animal stockmanship. For more information, please visit our website, whiteoakpastures.com.
You are listening to Eyes on the Prize by Kendi Gable here on heritageradionetwork.org.
We can see, but yet we're so blind.
Welcome back to Taste Matters. I'm your host, Mitchell Davis. I'm talking with Dan Kluger, the part of the James Beard Award-winning team, Best New Restaurant 2011 at ABC Kitchen, but whose experience he brings from a vast number of wonderful New York restaurants, among them Union Square Cafe, the restaurant that still brings tears into people's eyes when you mention it. It's an amazing core, fundamental resonance with New York sort of food history. I said I was going to change topic, but during the break, while we were listening to that wonderful voice of the rancher, you said that one of the hardest things for you to find is a consistent supply of grass-fed beef or quality grass-fed beef. And we hear that a lot. I was actually part of a sustainable meat hackathon, a whole other conversation we can have in Silicon Valley, where seven organizations were presenting challenges to 250 bright minds about how to do something to improve the supply, the appreciation, the flow through of high quality grass-fed beef. What's going on there? Why is that a challenge?
I mean, I think obviously in this part of the country, grass-fed beef is going to be a challenge just based on the weather and
the grass.
The grass,
right?
But I, you know, shamefully, I'd say that the tastings I've done of different levels and different cuts and different farms for grass-fed beef, I've very rarely been incredibly excited by it.
Mm.
And I think part of it is a little bit the notion of what a steak is and
right,
what it should taste like. And if we take away the animal cruelty or the whatever issues people have with, you know, mm-hmm, corn-fed beef and the sustainability of it and the environment effects of it, if we take that away and we just look at it as like this luxurious product, kind of like foie gras, you know, for me, every once in a while, in moderation, I enjoy it.
Right.
So it's very hard to think about grass-fed beef as this more common alternative. Because, again, if we take away some of the aspects of it, for me, a steak is, you know, corn-fed,
right.
It's marbled, it's juicy.
That was exactly our challenge that we presented at the hackathon, was how do we change the value proposition of the flavor of corn-fed beef, or can we even change it to say, oh, this tastes this way, this is what it ought to be, right. I'll pay for this and not this other thing.
Right.
I mean, the reality is, even if we were to be able to grass-feed all the beef in the world, we probably shouldn't eat as much of it anyway, right? So
exactly.
Your point about it creating a luxury out of it, you know, the sort of Kobe position where beef lives in a very rarefied, once-in-a-while place could be better for everything.
Yeah, I mean, I just came from Japan and, you know, we were doing something with Kobe beef over there and, you know, taking little snippets off of each piece and eating them during service. It was like, all right, this is a good steak.
It's insane, right?
Yeah. It's amazing. So again, you know, to me, I look at that as a luxury. And the few times that I eat steak a year, unless it's like a really amazing steak, it almost feels like a waste of calories, a waste of time. So again, I would rather focus on it being a luxury, knowing that it's something that maybe wasn't the best sustainable thing. Mm-hmm. But again, I had it in small amounts. But in terms of an everyday beef, I think, you know, the problem with the grass-fed beef, like I said, is it's a notion of what a steak tastes like,
right.
Whether it's dry-aged or whether it's the Kobe really fatty, you know, marbled. And so I think it becomes a need to use the cuts differently with the grass-fed. And for me, you know, I like a short rib. I love a hanger steak. But typically when we're looking for steak, we're looking for like a strip or, you know,
right.
Ribeye or something like that. And so that's where our focus has always been. So
right.
I gotta find one at some point.
Right.
But
I've been told by some steak people it exists. It can happen. That
yeah.
there are quality producers as there are of everything. But
I mean, Mike Anthony's burger at Gramercy Tavern is grass fed, and I love it.
Right.
Again, I think if I'm not mistaken, he does it as a special, and it's like when it's gone, it's gone.
Right.
And I think part of that is probably an issue of what we found when we started talking to a couple of the local farmers about grass-fed beef is they felt like they were not going to be able to keep up with what we needed. You know, when we do a strip loin, we go through about 2 strip loins in a night. So
two whole primal cuts, right?
So that's a cow,
right? There you go.
Where's everything else going?
Where is it, right? I want to remind people listening, which I didn't do earlier, that you can call in. There's a few minutes left. Our phone number is 718-497-2128. We'll take your question on air. Or if you're listening to the podcast or you prefer to write, we're at info@heritageradionetwork.org. That's the email. And our Twitter handle is TasteMattersHRN. Let's move the conversation a little bit to taste. It's the name of our show, and it's we're talking about it here in the context of meat and what we value in the taste profile of a steak. But I'm curious, one of the challenges I think that people find with vegetables is, and one of the things that I think is so amazing about them, is that they are so varied in taste. Like, you know, a salad can be so many things that in some ways what a chef does or brings to it, can seem puzzling, I think, except there are cultures, of course, that have vast vegetable cookery as part of their cuisine. And I'm wondering, when you're thinking about a dish, when you're trying to be responsive to the seasons, respectful of the ingredient, but also you draw on so many different flavors and so many different culinary traditions, what's the creative process? I'm just curious. How do you distinguish your Brussels sprouts, or do you even care to? And what do you communicate to the cooks and about the vision of the profile of what of your food in general?
You know, I think it depends. Sometimes the inspiration, for lack of a better word, really comes from a memory or something we saw, a trip we took, or it's really much driven by the season. Walking through the farmer's market, we happen to, you know, pick up Brussels sprouts in one hand and pick up something in another hand and think, wow, these two would go well together, and that becomes something. But, you know, ultimately, for me, taste is, taste is hitting all these different senses, and how they, essentially how they hit the sensory parts of your tongue and create these different parts of the beginning part of taste, and then vision or the smell, the presentation, the texture, all these things affect taste. So when I cook, it's trying to hit on all those notes in the best possible way, but in a simple way. So if you take something like Brussels sprouts, which are, you know, this cabbagey flavor, we then look at what are we going to do in order to create texture and flavor just on the Brussels sprouts. So in this case, we typically will blanch them and then roast them till really crispy, so you have this caramelization, sweet, cabbagey kind of flavor to it. It gets a little char to it, which is almost reminiscent of a steak, brings out this meatiness. But they're fully tender, so there's not this big crunch to it. It's just like it melts in your mouth, but it's crunchy on the outside. And then we think about things that go well with the Brussels sprouts or with cabbage. And, you know, for me, mustard always comes to mind. So mustard typically makes it into it in some form or another. And then from there, trying to hit on sweet and sour, and is it going to be a salad? Is it going to be a side dish? Is it part of an entree? And so things kind of just take shape from there. And sometimes they start out with one mindset and completely veer off to another. And again, it could be just happen to pick something else up in the walk-in, or I just tasted something and then, you know.
I'm salivating listening to you. I want those Brussels sprouts. So people are so want to force others into categories. And I know when it comes to food, you know, we think of restaurants often, they're French, they're Italian. Sometimes California means something. These days, Brooklyn means something. It's funny. What do you think of that? Or, I mean, what you've just described is really looking at the elements of the ingredients, putting them together. Does it become American by definition of the environment and the style and who you are? Or is it really more freeform than that?
I think it depends very much on the ultimate vision of the chef restaurateur. You see the trends. We've grown up seeing trends of tons of French restaurants open. I mean, I grew up seeing a lot of Italian restaurants really take shape. But those had a very strict, strong focus on a cuisine.
Right.
Some had more of a play of seasonal, local ingredients.
But
some,
still in Italian or
still
in French,
Italian,
right?
Exactly. But there are also ones where it's like, no, everything's going to be imported, and we really don't care about the local. And there's nothing wrong with that. That was their focus. I think what you see now with a lot of the, you know, quote unquote American restaurants is maybe more playfulness in terms of not being trapped within a cuisine, and yet being able to focus on the local, or maybe being able to focus on it all being small plates or whatever it's going to be, but just not being labeled.
But by beyond the provenance of the ingredients, do you think there's something New York about your cooking? And I ask because, you know, we see chefs look around, you know, very overtly trying to establish some notion of a New York culinary identity. Certainly the environment feels very much the eating environment, I should say, the chicness of the design, which you wouldn't expect anything less from ABC. But do you think there's anything to an idea that your food is from this place besides the ingredients are from here?
I mean, again, you know, style wise, in terms of the actual dishes, I think it's hard to say that's New York. You know, we have pizza and pasta, very, very Italian.
Sure.
We have raw fish, which could be Italian. It could be Asian, you know, Japanese. We have carrots that are sort of inspired by Morocco.
Okay.
So in terms of that, it's...
And putting them all together, it could be New York, just on one menu, right?
Exactly. And I think, you know, that does somewhat create it. But I think probably what creates sort of the New York... theme, so to speak, behind the restaurant would just be the fact that, you know, we're really focused on using things from New York.
Right.
We shop at the farmer's market, which is a block away from us.
Right.
Our a lot of our cheese comes from New York or Jersey. A lot of our dairy comes from New York, et cetera, et cetera. So right. I think that becomes New York. But, you know, pinpointing a New York style, I think is very tough today. I mean, you know, you just looked at, let's look at the New York Times dining section this morning. There's a whole thing on the new New York sushi chefs.
And, right.
You know, I was flabbergasted. Like, here are three guys that are all completely different, all from different walks of life, all doing amazing sushi.
Right.
So I think the New York food versus California cuisine, I think it'll be a lot harder to ever really define what it is.
One last note. You were just in Japan. You just mentioned sushi. Are there going to be more Asian things on your menu? Are we going to see Japan appear? Some inspiration there?
You know, typically when I travel and I come back, I'm very inspired in some form or another. I would say this trip, as amazing as it was less inspiring in terms of creating dishes, more inspiring just in terms of their overall cuisine, in terms of how many different things there are that are like these, you know, amazing specialties, whether it's sushi, obviously, or, you know, okonomiyaki, or the ramen, or the soba. Like, right. There's so many things that are so specific to all of Japan.
Right.
And each one of them are like, you know, this is my
fully
ramen.
Articulated, right. And we just think of sushi as Japanese, and it's just one of 100.
Yeah. Types, yeah. I mean, the stuff that we get here is so different than what you get there, and not in a good, bad way. It's just, I remember having a conversation with somebody. Say, yeah, we don't really do that here. We don't really see that here.
Right.
So it's it was very eye opening in terms of that. But I didn't come back thinking like I need to pull from all these different things.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to come speak with us. Cool. You probably have, let's see, Brussels sprouts and cabbage and things to deal with back at the shop, so to speak. Always a pleasure to
thank
talk
you.
To you.
Thank you.
Next week, we are welcoming to the show someone I don't know who we are. Raj Patel. Sorry, Ashley is whispering, and it's probably written on a piece of paper in front of me I didn't see. Yes, at the top of the page there. Raj Patel, who's a great thinker about the relationship of the global food system to the decisions that we make and vice versa. He was participated in the James Beard Foundation Annual Food Conference. You've heard a few guests already from there, and there'll be a few more in the pike. We'll look forward to that conversation. In the meantime, if you can't find your way to ABC Kitchen or Cocina, why don't you think about this idea of working in a really realizing some of the ideas that we talk about when we consider sustainability, seasonality, local food, what that means, whether it's labor issues, flavor issues, or just the joy of shucking a lot of peas. And we'll be back next week at 11 o'clock on Wednesday. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.